to Robert.
Thank you, Sophie. Let me begin with what I anticipate everyone will already know, but just so we have it at the front of our minds, if we can have the first slide, just to remind ourselves of the key parts of the legislation. And the main section being section 9A, which provides a mandatory duty on the courts. The court must make a disqualification order if those two conditions are satisfied. The first, an undertaking which the company of which he's a director commits a breach of competition law, which can obviously be chapter one or chapter two. And the second condition is that the court considers that his conduct as a director makes him unfit to be concerned in the management of a company. And I'm just going to ask you just to retain in your mind those words, his conduct as a director makes him unfit. And we'll come back to consider the significance of that in a moment. Let's just go on to the next slide for a bit more of the legislation. Section 9A, subsection 5, says that for the purposes of deciding whether that second condition is met, whether a person is unfit to be concerned in the management of a company, the court must have regard to whether subsection 6 applies to him, as well as those two other matters there. Obviously, any other breaches of competition law and Schedule 1 we're not concerned with, because that's uniquely concerned with the original company director disqualification regime. But look at A, must have regard to. And the only point I'm going to make here is that ostensibly, deliberately makes clear that the matters with which subsection 6 are concerned is just one of the matters to have regard to. It's not in any way exclusive. So let's look at subsection 6 on the next slide. And this subsection applies to a person if, as a director of the company, and then we have three probable alternatives, although they may apply variously if there's more than one breach of competition law involved. But the first one is his conduct contributed to the breach of competition law. The second is his conduct did not contribute to the breach, but he had reasonable grounds to suspect that the conduct of the undertaking constituted the breach, and he took no steps to prevent it. And the third is he did not know, but ought to have known, that the conduct of the undertaking constituted the breach. So that might well be read as being in descending order of gravity, obviously contributing at one end of the scale, at the other end of the scale, not knowing, but lapsing in a duty of a director to keep an eye on what's going on in the company and how the undertaking is being run in practice. So that is those are the matters to which the court must have regard. Let's have the next slide. And just three other provisions for clarification of that. For the purposes of that first subsection, that's contributing to the breach of competition law, it's immaterial whether the person knew that the conduct of the undertaking constituted the breach. In other words, ignorance of competition law won't in itself have any significance or amount to any kind of mitigation. Note here, just because it's convenient, that the maximum period of disqualification under this section is 15 years. There's similar provisions in other parts of the Act in relation to the more conventional original forms of director disqualification, but those other provisions also apply provide for a minimum of 2-year disqualification. But in the particular context of a competition disqualification order, there is no minimum. And one other section from the legislation, just to remind ourselves that conduct includes omission. So against that background, having refreshed our memory on that, I was going to put that into the context of the first case, which was contested at the CMA against Michael Martin, in which I represented Mr. Martin, the director. And this was, of course, the Burnham-on-Sea estate agents cartel. And Mr. Martin was a director of one of the estate agent companies which was implicated in that cartel activity. Now, he was a director of a much larger business operation than that. He had a number of different businesses. He was not an estate agent himself. He had no hands-on day-to-day management role in the estate agent's business itself. But the CMA's case was put in a form of a number of alternatives. And in essence, they reflect the tiered approach in subsection six, the A, B, C of matters to which the court may have regard. And so putting it at its highest, the CMA alleged that he had actively encouraged the proposal to make a price fixing agreement and thereafter acquiesced in or agreed to the participation of Gary Berryman, that's Gary Berryman Limited, that was his estate agent, in the infringement, or by his failure to prevent or discourage the proposal to make a price fixing agreement and or Gary Berryman's participation in the infringement. So they were both said to amount to contribution to the breach. That's, if you like, A under subsection six. But then the alternative, if we take the next slide, if he didn't contribute to the breach, the CMA's case was that regardless of whether he knew about the infringement, he had reasonable grounds to suspect that the conduct of Gary Berryman constituted the breach and he took no steps to prevent it. So that was a B. And they ran a further alternative case under C that he ought to have known that the conduct of Gary Berryman constituted the breach. Now, when the CMA served notice on Mr. Martin that they were going to apply for a disqualification order, they made clear two things. Firstly, that they sought at that stage a 3-year disqualification. And secondly, that if he were to consent to give an undertaking instead of necessitate the application for the order, the CMA would accept a 2-year, 6-month undertaking. But they reserved the right to seek a longer disqualification if the order was contested. And that really reflected, again, that distinction between the A, the B, the C, the different tiers of seriousness, if you like. But they made clear that they were going in for 3 years. Let's have the next slide. The result, as you may know, is that Judge Jones found that Mr. Martin had known of the breach and had allowed Berryman to participate in it and perform it. And although he hadn't been directly involved in the activities in the sense of attending meetings where the agreement was struck, his conduct as a director had contributed to the breach. And the judge held that he ought to have reported his employees' conduct to the board and ought to have taken all possible steps to prevent it. So that squarely fell within A. And the result was that the court didn't need to consider the precise scope or to consider how the matters under B or C would have applied or would have been taken into account. So this was found to be serious misconduct, which made him unfit. And the result was a 7-year disqualification order. By this stage, those findings of fact having been made, the CMA were seeking an even longer disqualification order than that, up to 10 years. But having taken into account various matters of mitigation, that is what the court settled on. Let's take the next slide. But the question in my mind is a what if, because Mr. Martin denied all three limbs of the CMA's case. And it's clear from the fact that the CMA were initially prepared to go for a 3-year order or accept a 2.5-year disqualification, that they didn't at that stage of proceedings until the full investigation had been completed and all evidence had been filed before court and Mr. Martin had been cross-examined and his evidence found wanting. They were clearly prepared to approach this case on the basis that one of the lesser tiers would have been applicable. And that raises a question in my mind. What if, take it away from Mr. Martin, there was another case in which a director doesn't contribute to a breach, so it's not an A case. He doesn't have reasonable grounds to suspect that the conduct of the undertaking constituted the breach and says, had he done so, he would have taken steps to prevent it. And he doesn't know of the conduct, but ought to have known that the conduct of the undertaking constituted a breach. In other words, what if we had a pure C case? And there's clearly a range of possible circumstances falling within the rubric of C. It could just be a single oversight by a director, or it could be a complete dereliction of a director's duty to familiarize himself with what's going on in the business. And in either case, it might be said that he ought to have known that the conduct was occurring and constituted a breach. And let's move on to the next slide. And in those circumstances, it seems to me that a human rights argument might have real significance. Now, as those of you who have read the Martin judgment might know, I ran a Human Rights Act argument, arguing that in light of the Human Rights Act, Company Director Disqualification Act had to be read through the lens of Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights and had to be read down in certain respects. Now, on the findings that the court actually made, that Mr. Martin had knowingly contributed to the breach, that argument would obviously never get us anywhere, even if in principle the court had been prepared to accept that the effect of the Human Rights Act was, as I'd argued it to be, was clearly proportionate to disqualify a director who had knowingly contributed to a breach of competition law. But what if we had this pure C case in which proportionality could arguably make a difference? Let's just look at the approach that the court applied, which is to apply what you might call the traditional approach, which has been applied over a period of 25 years since the original Company Director Disqualification Act 1986, which was obviously amended by the Enterprise Act to introduce competition disqualification orders. But it's going to traditional director disqualification orders. The way that's been interpreted and is authoritatively set out in the judgment of Lord Justice Hoffman in the leading authority, Ray Graham Building Services, is that an order must be made if the director's conduct viewed cumulatively and taking into account any extenuating circumstances has fallen below the standards of probity and competence appropriate for persons fit to be directors of companies. Now, you might say, if you apply that test and find that someone's conduct has fallen below that standard, well, on the face of it, why on earth shouldn't they be disqualified? Why on earth could it be said that it would be disproportionate to do so? But here's where closer examination of the authorities applying to director disqualification really sheds a bit more light on that, because it's quite clear from those authorities that what the court has to examine and focus on, the words tunnel vision are used in the authorities, is the actual conduct of which the director is accused, including any extenuating circumstances relating to that conduct specifically. But it specifically excludes consideration of the director's wider conduct. So a director might have conducted himself in exemplary fashion in other respects. He might even, for the sake of argument, have clamped down on previous potential breaches of competition law to ensure they didn't happen. He might have introduced a company-wide training policy to make everyone aware of competition law and what its requirements were. But all of that on the traditional approach would be relevant only to mitigation and wouldn't at all detract from the mandatory duty on the court to make a disqualification order if the specific conduct complained of, in our context by the CMA, viewed cumulatively and taking into account extenuating circumstances, falls below the standards of probity and competence appropriate. And you don't look any wider than that on the traditional approach. Have the next slide, Sophie. So, for example, to take another authority, post-Ray Graham, in Arif, it was said by the Court of Appeal has explained in Ray Graham that it's not open to a court to decide to make no order for disqualification by reason of events which have occurred during the period between the date of the failure of the company and the date of the order. Once a finding of unfit conduct has been made, the court is required to make a disqualification order, notwithstanding that it may be satisfied that as at the date of the order, no further protection is required for the public. So even if it reaches that view on the traditional approach, nonetheless, a disqualification order is mandatory. Let's take the next slide. OK, continuing with Arif, it's clear, therefore, that there will be cases in which the court's required to make a disqualification order of 2 years. This, of course, is in the context where 2 year minimum is mandatory, in circumstances in which it's satisfied both A, that that's the longest period of disqualification which could be appropriate, having regard to the nature of the unfit conduct which is identified, and B, that the effect of the proceedings has been already to prevent the respondent from acting as a director for more than 2 years. And in such a case, the period of pending proceedings couldn't be taken into account. And that's just worth pausing on as well for a moment, because these proceedings can be quite lengthy and drawn out in nature. They all follow on, of course, from a previous finding of an infringement of competition law, so following the entire period of investigation and the publication of that decision, giving rise to a separate process looking into the director's specific conduct and considering all the representations, going through the entire process, as well as then awaiting a court date, which could easily take 2 years, during which a director may well be de facto disqualified, and that he felt, as Mr. Martin in fact did, obliged to step down from the board of his company, really to protect the company in particular in respect, for example, of its position with respect to the bank and the bank's willingness to extend further credit, for example. All sorts of reasons might well be coming into account. But even if there has been a de facto disqualification for 2 years, and 2 years is about right, still you have to ignore all that completely and impose a 2 year disqualification order from that point. Let's have the next slide. And consider In re Pamstock, again, another of the old cases. This predates Re Grayan, but it's absolutely on a par with it, where a judge felt compelled to impose a disqualification order, despite the fact, as you can see from my underlined text, that he considered that a disqualification order is likely to have a disproportionately severe effect on the director. And look at how that is identified. Apart from the stigma of a disqualification order, it will be difficult and maybe impossible for him to continue in his career as the provider of venture capital and as a professional non-executive director if he must seek leave before accepting any appointment. However, under the legislation as it now stands, I'm required to have tunnel vision and to consider whether in relation to Pamstock, the company, the director's conduct fell short of the minimum standard which the court today requires to be observed by the director, and if it does, to impose a disqualification order for a minimum of 2 years. So again, this is obviously, all these cases I've been talking about are pre-Human Rights Act cases, and there is the court explicitly acknowledging that the order is likely to have a disproportionately severe effect on them before Human Rights Act, before there could be any possibility of a proportionality argument. And going back finally to In re Grayan and Lord Justice Hoffman, I'm sorry, we can go on that next slide, that's it. And just to quote from him again, the question is whether his conduct makes him unfit to be concerned in the management of a company. Mr. Bannister, counsel for the director in that case, submitted that this required the court to be satisfied that the defendant was at the time of the hearing a person who, for the future protection of the public, shouldn't be allowed to concern himself in the management of a company. And should look at the court, should therefore look at any evidence which showed that despite the defendant's shortcomings in the past, he was unlikely to offend again. I do not agree, said Lord Justice Hoffman. He went on to say, in my view, the construction for which Mr. Bannister contends is not consistent with the court having a duty to disqualify a director whose conduct has shown him to be unfit. And if the court always had to be satisfied at the hearing that the protection of the public required a period of disqualification, there would be no need to make disqualification mandatory. So explicitly contemplating, again, the possibility that the protection of the public doesn't require a period of disqualification. And let's go on in that quote. So even if the court had a discretion, it would not have formed the view that disqualification was necessary in the public interest, be acting judicially if it didn't make a disqualification order. The purpose of making disqualification mandatory was to ensure that everyone whose conduct had fallen below the appropriate standard was disqualified for at least 2 years, whether in the individual case the court thought that this was necessary in the public interest or not. Parliament has decided that it's occasionally necessary to disqualify a company director to encourage the others. And those words, perhaps recalling the words of Voltaire, pour encourager les autres, and the execution of Admiral Byng. If there was any possible image which was more at odds with a proportionate approach under the Human Rights Act, I think it's probably difficult to come up with one. So can a Human Rights Act argument work? Can it help? Well, in an appropriate case where some of those concerns become real, which they didn't on the findings of fact in Mr. Martin's case, but where a court concluded that it's not necessary in the public interest to disqualify a particular individual director, I maintain that there is such an argument, and let's look at how it might work. Starting point is that Article 8 ECHR is engaged. And I set out there, I think these slides will be circulated afterwards, so I won't go through it all, but some of the authorities, I didn't dwell, because both the CMA and the court accepted in Martin that Article 8 was engaged. And that's because it obviously affects someone's business and private life and obviously their ability to pursue a chosen career in certain employments. And it can also have an adverse effect on the person's reputation. So through all of that route, Article 8 can be engaged, and obviously the making of an order will interfere with those aspects of a person's private life. And as soon as you cross that threshold, it means that that interference must be justified. Let's go to the next slide. Now, of course, we easily cross the thresholds and that interference being in accordance with the law. We've got the Act to tell us so. And there'd be no question that it serves a legitimate aim. But then the question becomes one of proportionality. Now, in Martin, acknowledging that on the findings of fact, this was never going to get me anywhere, but as a matter of principle, nonetheless, the argument was put forward that all those previous authorities I've taken you through, Grayan, Arif, Pamlock, and indeed others, now need to be read in light of the requirement of proportionality imported with effect from 2000 by the Human Rights Act. Further, that Section 3 allows legislation to be read down. So, for example, you could have the ostensibly mandatory duty to be read as being subject to a caveat, except insofar as it would be incompatible with Article 8 to do so, to impose that disqualification order. And I won't run through all the authorities on the power of the Human Rights Act and the interpretive obligation to read in words to a statute, but I've given an example of a Supreme Court decision concerning confiscation orders in the criminal context, where an apparently mandatory duty was read down, saying except insofar as it would be incompatible with, in that case, Article 1, Protocol 1. Or another way of approaching the interpretation of the statute might be to go back to Ray Grayan and effectively reverse it and say, no, you don't have to focus only on the conduct which is complained of, but you could look at the wider conduct. You don't have to adopt tunnel vision. You could take into account all the circumstances in considering whether a director is unfit. And therefore, even before getting to the stage of the mandatory obligation, you can take into account as part of a proportionality assessment or in order to ensure that the legislation is proportionately applied, all the circumstances applying to the individual. And that would be consistent with the entire thrust of many, many cases on Article 8, many of them at Supreme Court level. I've given one example. Obviously, most of the authorities on Article 8 in the Supreme Court arise in the immigration context, but that shouldn't deter us from applying the principles at all. And in EB Kosovo, for example, Lord Justice Bingham specifically said that the search for a hard edge or bright line rule to be applied to the generality of cases is incompatible with the difficult evaluative exercise which Article 8 requires. And that's because Article 8 requires a concentration on individual circumstances of the individual case. Let's have the next slide. So what did the court say? The court said there's a flaw in that argument. The court said, the flaw is that it ignores sections 1 and 17 of the Act, which of course allow, as Deborah is going on to speak about, a disqualified director to apply for leave to act, to make an application to be permitted to act as a director in a specific set of circumstances and a specific role. It's that stage of the process, the judge said, that allows an individualized assessment of proportionality at that stage. And he said that the importance of public confidence in limited companies and the use of regulatory mechanisms to ensure respect for directors' duties justifies a mandatory disqualification. He said the fact that I had argued that a disqualified director must commit resources to apply for leave and will suffer reputational harm from the disqualification itself can't outweigh those interests, and that Parliament had legislated for competition disqualification orders in the knowledge of the operation of the previous director disqualification order and those past authorities, Ray Graham, and the effect of adopting this suggested approach would front load that section 17 leave procedure requiring an assessment of risk right from the outset, which would be more resource intensive and impracticable. Let's take the next slide. My submission that doesn't meet the full effect or thrust of the point. It fails to recognise the full effect of the Human Rights Act, which requires that individualised assessment and requires regard to be had to all the surrounding circumstances to assess whether a particular interference with Article 8 is proportionate. This is, in my view, the Ray Graham approach, a narrow and artificially narrow tunnel vision approach, which is difficult to square with any classical application of Article 8 principles. It fails to engage with the severe effect which a disqualification order can have on an individual, notwithstanding the Section 17 avenue to apply for leave. And indeed, if you go back to those earlier authorities, it explicitly acknowledged that indeed the order itself, the disqualification order, can have a severe effect. The stigma, career-ending possibilities, if you have to apply for leave every time, if you want to have a career as non-executive director, all of that is a consequence of the making of the disqualification order and isn't solved by the mere fact that you can apply for leave in respect of particular roles. The next difficulty is it treats the central purpose of the regime as being pour encourager les autres, rather than to assess the risk to the public presented by an individual and to protect the public from that risk. Of course, there is also a deterrent effect of the regime, but that doesn't mean it would be against the grain of the Act to acknowledge that the central purpose is to protect the public from an individual and his conduct of a company, and where there is no risk, that needn't require a finding of unfitness, where fitness has in fact been demonstrated by subsequent or surrounding conduct beyond the particular conduct complained of. So this argument fails to address that problem with the tunnel vision approach. And whilst apparently reflecting a concern for the burden on defendants, that is on the directors, as the judge put it, in fact, what it does is deprive defendants of an opportunity to satisfy the court that they present no risk to the public. And for that reason, it would be disproportionate to disqualify them. In practical terms, the success of this argument being revisited, the prospect of success of this argument on a future occasion will be limited at first instance in light of Judge Jones's approach, and in reality would have to be pursued at a higher level, in particular if there's to be a departure after so many years from Ray Graham. But I do consider that should a suitable case arise, and I know that there is widespread concern as to the enthusiasm for the CMA, of the CMA in seeking these orders, there remains strong potential for a proportionality argument to be made and ultimately to succeed, if only at a higher level. I think those are all the slides, Sophie. Thank you very much.
Thanks ever so much, Robert, for those insights, which I think very thoughtful, and it will be obviously interesting to see how they play out. We do have one more sort of slightly more basic question, which is as to whether an individual has to be a director of an infringing company to be disqualified or not. And I think, having had a quick reminder myself of the legislation, I think the answer is clearly yes. Under Section 9A2, it's a condition that making, which is a company of which the person is a director, commits a breach of competition law. Although interestingly, that contrasts slightly with the sort of overall approach of the Act, which doesn't specify that people have to be a director in the company sections. Although a lot of those breaches are to do with failure to fulfill directors' obligations, so it kind of comes in through that route anyway. So I think with that, I'll hand over to Deborah.
Thanks, Sophie. And thanks, Robert, for your talk, which was very interesting, perhaps an insight into the perils of running human rights arguments in insolvency courts. I may touch on some of the points that you raised about proportionality in the context of Section 17 of the Act, which will be the focus of my remarks today. As Sophie mentioned in her intro, I'm a partner in the antitrust litigation team at Fresh Fields. My experience with the world of competition disqualification orders arises from a case I worked on back in 2019, which actually does feel like a lifetime ago now, which was the Stamatis and Davis and CMA case, which arose out of the office fit-out cartel. And in that case, the CMA pursued directors' disqualifications, as is its standard practice now, really in domestic cartel cases in particular. That case was the first competition director's disqualification case to reach a high court in the guise of an application for permission under Section 17 of the Act. So distinct, obviously, from Robert's case, this wasn't a challenge to the imposition of disqualification, but rather a court hearing in relation to the escape route or the pressure valve that exists under legislation, which is that directors can, notwithstanding being disqualified under Section 17, they can apply for limited permission to continue to act. So before we get there, though, I just want to go through some of the process that companies need to go through in the run-up to a Leave to Act application. We'll start off by talking about competition disqualification undertakings. Now, where the CMA is minded to pursue disqualification against a director, the first formal step will be to propose a disqualification undertaking under Section 9B of the Act. And an undertaking can be offered by the director concerned during investigation or indeed during court proceedings. 9B undertakings, therefore, are essentially voluntary disqualifications where the director agrees with the CMA essentially not to act as a director of a company up to that maximum period of 15 years that Robert was describing. If the CMA is minded to accept the undertaking, it will then be published at a company's house. The CMA will publish it on its website, and the director is, for all intents and purposes, fully disqualified, notwithstanding this being, as it were, voluntary. Now, the legislation is drafted in such a way as you would assume it was a step proactively for directors to take. And it's the CMA which then decides whether to accept it. Practical experience is the CMA may fire the starting gun on this and approach investigative directors with the possibility of an undertaking. And that is certainly something that it's done with regularity in recent years since the first undertaking was made in 2016. The CMA has accepted undertakings in 18 cases from 18 directors, whereas proceedings have only been initiated in 7 cases. So the undertaking seems to be the preferred route, and that obviously makes sense. There are obvious procedural economies. The CMA doesn't need to engage in a lengthy court process. It's able to negotiate these things potentially quickly. It achieves one of the CMA's key objectives, I'm sure, which is around deterrence and publicity in relation to the disqualification, because at the end of the day, an individual remains disqualified, and the CMA will make that plain in IFRS statements. So there's no need in this process to, as it were, go through a contested court hearing in relation to the matters giving rise to the director's unfitness for the purpose of the Act. What is required, though, is the production of a schedule of unfitness, which will accompany the undertaking, and that will set up a factual basis justifying the director's period of disqualification. Although this is tended to be done at a pretty high level, if we can move to the next slide, here's an example of an undertaking that was given by one Mr. Amit Patel in connection with the fludrocortisone acetate tablets cartel investigation. And you can see he agreed to a disqualification period of 5 years. If you look to the next slide, move on to the, yes, there we go. You'll see here's the schedule of unfitness. And it sets out the CMA's main findings in its CA98 investigation. And then the matters of unfitness, which is section B. So in relation to the director individually is rather brief, but summarizes the contribution that Mr. Patel made in that case. Now, at an early stage in the CMA's process, this is all that would be given to the individual. This schedule would be provided in draft form, and the individual has to make the decision there, the director has to make the decision there as to whether to accept an undertaking at that point. Now, this can present some challenges to a director because of the approach that the CMA takes as a matter of policy in relation to discounts. The CMA will, as I say, offer an undertaking at an early stage and will say, if you accept an undertaking, here are the facts that give rise to our view that you ought to be disqualified. If we took this to court, we may seek a disqualification period of up to 5 years. But if you accept this undertaking, we'll give you 3 years. That creates an incentive, obviously, to settle, as it were, early. That's completely understandable from a policy perspective. However, the CMA's approach will be that where an undertaking is not accepted early, that discount will decrease over time. So the time at which an undertaking is accepted will be relevant to the amount of a discount that may be offered. And that's made plain in CMA's guidance on CDOs, which came out a couple of years ago. It's updated guidance, where they say at power 3.7, we can go into the next slide, I think we have that there, that the CMA will normally consider a reduction in the disqualification period where a director offers a CDU in terms acceptable to the CMA. The stage in the proceedings at which the CDU is offered will be a relevant consideration when the CMA is considering whether to accept a reduction in the disqualification period, and if so, the extent of any such reduction. But as I say, the CMA's practice will be the later you leave it, the less of a discount is offered. Now, that, as I say, just does present challenges in circumstances where the director may only have very limited information as to what the CMA considers to give rise to unfitness at the outset. And if the direction of travel is one way, they do have a potentially tough decision to make in terms of whether they accept an undertaking early, knowing that if they hold out for more information, the period of the undertaking may get longer. The CMA obviously will justify this by reference to procedural efficiencies. As I say, their policy is made plain, so people do go into the process with knowledge of the risks. But the experience certainly that I've had, I'm not sure if this is universal, but the experience that I've had is that it is one-way traffic. The disqualification period will only increase And there's nothing in the legislation that suggests that has to be the case. And certainly CMA's guidance doesn't say that it will universally be the case that the disqualification discount, you know, will only go down over time. And is stated as being only a relevant consideration. And it seems to me there may be cases where, for example, on the facts, information may emerge as to the level of involvement the director truly had, which may not, for example, have been evident in the CA98 process. And if so, that to my mind ought to justify the CMA keeping its discretion more open in those circumstances. But you know, as I say, the approach typically, so the CMA has discretion, the approach typically is that the longer one leaves it, the discount will go down. And that is obviously something that we have to work through with the clients and advising them on this process. So moving on then to section 17. Obviously you may decide to agree to an undertaking of whatever duration. That isn't necessarily though then the end of the story. So you've been undertaking or you've had a CDO ordered against you. What are your options then? Well, as I've said, Section 17 does provide for the possibility for an individual to continue to act as a director of a company where a need can be established. And I do emphasize the word need. Now, this may seem potentially somewhat contradictory if the CMA has reached the view that a director is ought to be disqualified, but there's a public protection purpose for disqualification. Why should a director be able to apply to continue to act? Surely that's contrary to the purpose of disqualification. Well, as I say, this is a pressure valve mechanism, which is strictly limited. And it is calibrated to the needs of, in particular, public protection. So as we see from the slide, and this is from the Marija case, Maria, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, which isn't a competition case, but espouses the relevant principles and has been followed in competition cases, the case that I acted on. This makes clear that when deciding upon permission to act under Section 17, there's essentially a two-stage balancing exercise. First, whether there's a need for the individual to act as a director, and that is predominantly the need of the company question, with respect to which the application is being made. And then secondly, should permission be granted, whether the public would be adequately protected from repetition of the misconduct that led to the applicant's disqualification in the first place. So this is essentially a forward looking analysis. In contrast to the position under Section 9A for a disqualification order, there the court will look at, as Robert has explained, you know, issues of the extent to which the individual was unfit to be involved in management of the company by virtue of whether their previous conduct contributed to the breach of competition law, whether actively or passively, whether they should have known or had reasonable grounds to suspect the ABC that Robert was describing earlier. However, once unfitness has been established and a disqualification has either been ordered or an undertaking has been agreed, essentially that goes into the background. The book is closed on that, and Section 17 looks forward. What is in the interest of public protection here? And it's clear from case law in traditional disqualification contexts, insolvency, corporate crime and the like, the court has emphasised that an application of the Section 17 is not intended to be viewed of as a further opportunity to consider punishing the director. And the background factors, the reasons for disqualification in the first place, ought only to be relevant to a Section 17 application insofar as they are relevant to determining need and the interest of public protection. So to try and bring that to life, I'll talk a little bit about the Forefront case, which I acted on, Reef Forefront Group Limited. So also known as Stamatis and Davis versus the CMA. So we acted for two directors of Forefront Group, which is, as I say, an office sort of fit-out company. The office fit-out sector had been involved in anti-competitive activity in breach of Chapter 1 of the CA 98, essentially cover pricing behaviour in particular. That was determined, various companies were fined, and then director disqualifications were pursued subsequent to the CA 98 case being closed. Now, in this case, the two directors we acted for, Mr. Stamatis and Mr. Davies, accepted disqualification undertakings of 2 years and 9 months and 1 year and 6 months, respectively. The length, the durations of the undertakings are important, as I'll come back to. And that was for their contribution in the program of anti-competitive conduct that the CMA had identified. Both of these directors were found to have essentially been passively involved rather than actively. So they were pursued on the basis that they had reasonable grounds to suspect the anti-competitive conduct or to have known the anti-competitive conduct was happening rather than being primary actors in the conduct themselves. Now, after agreeing undertakings with the CMA, having gone through the process that I was describing earlier, Mr. Stamatis and Mr. Davis applied for permission to act under Section 17, and indeed the Section 17 route was one the CMA themselves pointed out was available in the circumstances. Now, in the case, we were successful in persuading the court that there was a need for these individuals to continue to act as directors and that the public would be sufficiently protected from any repetition of the misconduct. I should say that was against the opposition of the CMA. There was a contested hearing on this. So on need, we move to the next slide. Yeah, so on need, we'd submitted evidence from the directors themselves and other directors in the company that explained the importance of the individuals in question's role and produced financial information supporting that to demonstrate that the company was in real risk of not surviving unless these individuals could continue to act as directors. On public protection, our judge was Deputy Insolvency Court Judge Beister, who was persuaded by the extensive competition compliance measures that we had proposed in line with CMA standards, and we'd sought to correspond with the CMA on these proposals. The CMA did comment upon some of our ideas in this regard. These were factored in. But we essentially put in place top-of-class competition compliance systems and put in affidavit evidence to explain how that would all work. Those measures included the appointment of a solicitor with specific compliance responsibilities as a non-executive director, the introduction of a competition compliance policy with regular training, and also an undertaking to perform regular email server searches for high-risk terms, so that and then reports would be provided to the compliance director who'd come in, so that they'd be able to spot and root out any anti-competitive conduct. We'd also offered to make regular reports to the CMA on a forward-looking basis. The directors in question also expressed profound regret as to their prior conduct. And these were accepted by the judge at face value. This was despite the CMA's criticism of the applicant's behaviour in previously denying knowledge of the anti-competitive conduct. The judge stated, notwithstanding the criticism of the CMA on this, that the directors in this case were entitled to, quote, trim their sails to the best prevailing wind. Now, in terms of the sort of the starting point for the judge's approach here, in determining the application, on the facts, he viewed the starting point in terms of the sort of conduct as being the undertakings that had been agreed. He felt that told the complete story, and therefore chose not to deal with oral submissions that were made at the trial from the CMA to emphasise the unfitness of these individuals by making those submissions as the gravity of conduct in question. So I think that's an important practical point, that when one is, for example, in an undertakings process and agreeing a schedule of unfitness, that is going to be the starting point for the judge in then determining the Section 17 application. One quirk of this process, in contrast to regular disqualifications in an insolvency context, is that the directors here were obviously applying to be directors of the same companies that they had been directors of in the context of the facts that gave rise to the unfitness and gave rise to disqualification. Now, that is obviously going to be fairly common. You would assume in competition cases, assuming the company survives, the director is going to be looking to stay as a director of that company. I suppose in an insolvency context where the company's gone bust, the director will be looking to become a director of a different company. That was a point that the CMA's Silk made at the hearing. And packaged up as a point that granting permission to act as a director for the same company would undermine the deterrent effect of the disqualification regime. And the judge, I think, took a very sort of pragmatic approach here, based on his experience as an insolvency judge, noting that insolvency disqualifications weren't necessarily materially different in that, you know, where a director applies to be a director of a formerly new company post insolvency, that will often be, in material respects, the same company in terms of having similar assets and having taken over the goodwill of the previous company. So he didn't consider that argument to necessarily hold water. He also rejected a broader deterrence argument that the CMA had made in this case, which was, you know, this was, as I say, the first hearing. CMA did make a point that that it would be inappropriate for the deterrence purpose of the competition disqualification regime generally, but for leave to be act to be granted in this case. I must say, I did find that an odd submission, in that there will always be a first case under this regime. But nevertheless, it was a submission that was made. But it was a submission that was rejected by the judge in this case, who noted that, you know, there had already been fundamental change within the company here, and that provided sufficient deterrence. I can move to the next slide. All that notwithstanding, I think it's important to underline that permission for leave to act, It's not a rubber stamping exercise. That was, as the judge says, as you can see from the quote, the quotation on the screen. Ultimately, this was a determination, a balancing that was reached on the evidence. And the evidence in this case convinced the judge that the balance should be tipped in favor of permission. But that is clearly going to be fact sensitive. And there will be other cases where a different conclusion is reached, I'm sure. So moving on, I mean, if we could go to the next slide. This is the Martin case, which Robert has already discussed, so I won't go into any detail. One of the points that is interesting from my perspective, looking at it almost from the other end of the telescope, me in my case starting from Section 17, whereas Robert in his case starting at Section 9 and having contested disqualification hearing. So as Robert's explained, in the Martin case, it was suggested somehow that Section 17 was perhaps the appropriate vehicle for which some of the issues that he raised in his case around proportionality essentially should be considered. And that it wasn't therefore necessary to read in a proportionality test under Section 9A. Now, I agree with Robert, given still my traditional area of practice in public law and commercial human rights. I think that's unsatisfactory, given what the Human Rights Act 98 demands. But there we are, that was the decision reached in that case. Nevertheless, I mean, if that's the route that the Insolvency Court wants to take in this case, does that mean that in a Section 17 case, is there scope for bringing in some wider proportionality arguments? We argued our case in a sort of very traditional way on straightforward need of proportionality following the insolvency and traditional disqualification case law. And you know, to be candid, that was a tactic too. One of the peculiarities of this regime is that you know, this isn't going to be a hearing in the Competition Appeal Tribunal. You are dealing with insolvency judges in the Insolvency Court. So as not to scare the horses, frankly, we pitched it in an orthodox way. So we avoided bringing in arguments around the human rights of our folks being engaged. Although obviously we did, in the context of need, did talk about individual needs, did talk about personal circumstances to some extent, but we avoided badging that in any kind of Article 8 language. Okay, moving on to then some other recent developments. In the Robin Davies and TMA case, I hasten to add, no relation to my Mr. Davies as far as I'm aware, but you know, this is quite a recent case in December 2020 where the High Court granted Mr. Davies permission to act as a director of companies in the Alyssa Healthcare Group, which was found to have exchanged commercially sensitive pricing information. Mr. Davies has been disqualified for 2 years for directly participating in the infringing conduct. Mr. Davies made an application for leave to act. This was, again, as we understand it, argued conventionally around need and public protection. In that case, he argued that Alyssa Healthcare... Oh, what's that slide? Never mind. I'll just carry on talking. I didn't think we necessarily need the slides, but... okay. Mr. Davies argued that Alyssa Healthcare was an essential business as a pharmaceutical supplier during the pandemic, and there was no one suitable to replace Mr. Davies as he was the sole executive director. On public protection, there's some striking similarities to the approach that we took in the Forefront case. A non-exec had been appointed to oversee the company's compliance with competition law. Other competition law measures which are evident from the order that was agreed in that case include maintaining a statement of commitment to competition law compliance on Alyssa companies' websites, providing annual competition law training to new joiners, giving the non-exec the right responsibility to review papers, make inquiries, attend board meetings, and the non-exec would have an appropriate budget to enable he or she to refer competition regulatory compliance queries to external legal counsel as appropriate. Notably, unlike our case, the CMA did not oppose the application or raise any concerns to the High Court. The CMA doesn't have to oppose, but under the regime, it is required to appear and draw attention to any matters they consider to be relevant to the court. The relatively low disqualification period in question here may have been significant. One of the points I wanted to make then, moving on to disqualification periods, which is relevant to the Forefront case and potentially this case. I explained that the judge at the Forefront case stated that the schedule of unfitness was his starting point. Another aspect of that starting point is the disqualification period that had been ordered. Now, in our case, as I was explaining, this was 1 year and 6 months and 2 years and 9 months, so relatively short disqualifications. And some of that reflects the fact that obviously they had been agreed at a relatively early stage and there was that undertaking discount provided. Now, in the judge's view, in our case, that was relevant to the issue of public protection. He didn't accept our submission that this necessarily meant that because a low disqualification period was ordered, that somehow is reflective of there being a lower sort of gravity, a lower seriousness, and therefore less is required in the interest of public protection. His view was that competition law cases do potentially disclose dishonesty, and therefore, notwithstanding the length of the undertaking that had been agreed, they are serious. Nevertheless, as a matter of just plain practical reality, if there is a relatively short period of disqualification, that means the public only needs to be protected for a relatively short period of time. And so that did bear in his thinking in the balancing act. I just want to end by talking about disqualification periods more broadly. Through case law, there has been established the conventional disqualification context as sort of a range of gravity in relation to disqualifications. And this is the Rees Sevenoaks case, where there are essentially brackets. Disqualifications for over 10 years would be reserved for particularly serious behavior, 6 to 10 years for serious cases, which do not meet the top bracket, and 2 to 5 years where the case is relatively, quote, not very serious. It's interesting to see where the CMA is going to go in terms of, you know, how it decides to approach the length of disqualification in given cases, depending on the nature of the participation of the director in the anti-competitive conduct and what type of anti-competitive conduct that is. The CMA didn't take up in its recent guidance the opportunity to sort of set out tariffs. You know, if it is hardcore price fixing, we ordinarily seek a disqualification period of 10 years plus to align with the sort of Sevenoaks concept of brackets. They haven't done that, but it seems to me that we are going to get a sense of that through the case law and the CMA's practice on undertakings over time. It seems that in recent cases, the direction of travel seems to be trending upwards. So in the Berkshire Estate Agency case, disqualification was given for a 6.5 year period. And the Lord Triptoline case, disqualification was given for 7 years. We haven't yet seen, for example, a disqualification, I believe, in the abuse of dominance context, for example. So it'd be interesting to see what approach CMA may take on severity there. Looking forward, these disqualifications are here to stay. It's a policy tool that the CMA has. It has a deterrent effect. They are looking to consider use of these powers in every case. It will be interesting to see the extent to which Section 17 applications will continue to be made. The CMA's approach reflected those. As I say, the Davies case at the end of last year, the CMA didn't oppose Section 17 application being made, so I think it will look to address that on a case by case basis. Obviously, the CMA, pursuant to the memorandum of understanding it now has with the Serious Fraud Office, may take over responsibility for looking at the criminal cartel offence itself. TBC, the extent to which criminal cartel proceedings will be pursued with more regularity than they have been to date, and challenging for all the reasons that people know. It seems to me that director disqualifications are are a useful tool and may be viewed of as an alternative to pursuing individual criminal cases because they have some of the same, arguably some of the same deterrence effect in that it is pursuing individuals. They are subject to a very public sanction as a result. A civil case may be viewed as being easier, more straightforward to pursue than a criminal case with the restrictions of pace that would have to go with that. I suppose a question would be the extent to which CMA may, for example, try and ride both horses and indeed use the threat of criminal investigation to encourage people further down the track of accepting undertakings. We'll wait to see what happens there. That's all from me. I think there were some hands up for questions.
Yes, so I think we had a question on the Q&A. Thanks, Deborah. About whether there's a tendency on the part of the insolvency court to sort of treat competition law issues as a sort of, well, you know, they're obviously not so familiar with competition law infringements. So is there a tendency on their part to treat things as sort of a form of almost strict liability? And I think, Robert, you were already in some aspects of this earlier, just in terms of the way the overall regime works in any event.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that there was any particular enthusiasm or hesitancy by the court to treat competition breaches as a strict liability issue. Obviously, the first condition was satisfied in Mr. Martin's case because the CMA investigation had reached a decision that the Bernamoncy estate agents had got together and formed a cartel, and there was no dispute as to that. The dispute was as to the second condition, which is whether Mr. Martin's conduct as a director made him unfit to be concerned in the management of the company. Of course, that all revolved around exactly how much he knew of it, how much he'd contributed to it, how much he should have known of it, issues such as that. I think the interesting issue is what happens when you get a pure C case, because as I called it earlier, the legislation doesn't say, you know, it's necessarily enough that someone, a director, ought to have known about a breach, even if they didn't in fact know of it. That's just a matter to which the court must have regard in deciding whether that director's conduct makes him unfit. So there's no encouragement, I would say, for a strict liability approach from that perspective from the legislation. As I say, the court in Mr. Martin's case didn't ultimately have to unpack or discuss C because it went with A, hanged Mr. Martin from the lamppost and decided that he'd been a direct contributor to the cartel. And that was certainly enough to get over the threshold. So I agree, Nicole, with your point. This is, as Deborah was saying, this does seem to be an easier route for the CMA to take than going down the criminal cartel prosecution. But there was no sort of reluctance or particular enthusiasm, if anything, enthusiasm, I suppose, for the court for establishing this was a serious matter. And they seemed to sort of relish having something different to do than insolvency, if I'm honest, and get stuck in.
Yeah, just to add to that, I mean, I sort of mentioned it in my remarks too, to some extent, in Section 17 case that I was dealing with. I mean, the judge there did say, well, you know, he accepts that competition law infringements, you know, make kind of dishonesty, and therefore do need to be treated seriously. But you know, these are also judges that I think, you know, do deal with, you know, real sort of hard-edged fraud, you know, bilking companies of money, raiding pension schemes and all that sort of stuff. So they may view themselves as you know, seeing really bad behaviour in their day-to-day practice. And so I don't think they necessarily would therefore say, oh, it's the CA98, that must be incredibly serious. I didn't get that sense from the demeanour of the judge in our case.
Well, thank you both very much. I mean, we are over time, but there's just one more point I'm quite interested in, which I think it partly stems from the sort of change in the CMA's process to run these things and run the direct disqualification issues sort of in parallel to the main case. But also just from, you know, and I think, Deborah, you've already alluded to the sort of pressure that can add to people as they're undertaking, you know, offers from the CMA sort of go up in terms of the tariff. But another thing that you can sort of see from the pattern of cases that have been concluded by the CMA so far is that they do tend to be the smaller director-led companies. And I do have a concern that the sort of disqualification powers disproportionately tend to affect the smaller businesses, which actually in a sort of more holistic sense, the CMA is keen to support. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that kind of aspect of the regime.
Robert, do you want to go first, having acted for a director directly?
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Martin's business was not so small. He had quite a large business going on, but his estate agency portfolio was small. He built up a chain of two or three local estate agents and essentially hired some people who he thought were good estate agents and left them to run it. That was certainly his defence, and he felt entitled to do that. So say the findings of fact say that he knew rather more about it than that might suggest. But I certainly share your concern, Sophie, that emphasis did seem to be on sort of easily takedownable directors who can be more closely, have their conduct more closely pinned on them. And I was equally concerned that it was quite a sort of a enthusiasm for holding back from disqualifying certain directors, not just if they'd taken formal advantage of leniency provisions, but if they'd played ball more roundly. And the result was that of the six estate agents concerned in this case, disqualifications were only made in respect of two or three of them and very few. And Mr. Martin ended up being disqualified for far longer, whereas even though he'd had no direct role in negotiating, setting up the cartel, initiating it, having the meeting, all of that had been done by others, and many others got away rather more scot-free. So I think there is an inconsistency of approach, and I think that inconsistency extends, as you suggested, to between small and large firms when directors' individual responsibilities may not be so clear.
I mean, for my part, I mean, some of this may reflect, obviously, and it could change post the end of the transition period. I mean, the reality is, obviously, a lot of the cases that the CMA had to run in recent years were necessarily about smaller companies because it was only sort of UK market only. Obviously, the CMA, and this was what they pursued in the case I was involved in, it was, you know, ought to have known, reasonable grounds to suspect that standard rather than direct involvement. You know, clearly, they want to and have successfully pursued cases on that basis. I suppose the question will be whether they take the leap and say, okay, so then for a bigger company with a more complex structure, does that mean that you know top board directors are in the firing line because they you know there's been an inadequate compliance system in place. That's going to be a leap, but certainly, you know, the evidence that they used in the case I was involved in order to substantiate unfitness, you know, that still came back to, you know, here were some emails and, you know, you were copied on them. So even though you hadn't actively turned your mind to the issue, clearly there was scope for you to have known about it. And that might be because of their awareness that, you know, this has to go through an absolutely court process. That's the quality of evidence the judge would expect to see.
Okay, well, thank you both very much. I think that's been a really, really useful session. And I think, you know, we'll be continuing to talk about this in the years to come. But for now, yeah, thank you both very much. I'd encourage the participants, as I say, to fill in the evaluation.